This is Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse. I'm Maureen McCollum. There were 31 deaths in La Crosse County between 2009 and 2011 related to heroin or similar drugs. Compare that to nearly 10 years ago, between 2000 and 2002, when there were 8 deaths. There were 141 heroin-related admissions at La Crosse's emergency rooms between the start of 2010 and last fall. Heroin is causing similar issues in towns big and small across Wisconsin. State lawmakers are now considering a number of bills designed to prevent heroin overdoses from occurring. State Senator Jennifer Schilling of La Crosse and State Representative John Nygren of Marinette were at a recent meeting of the La Crosse County Heroin and Illicit Drug Task Force. I sat down with them after the meeting to talk about the proposals the legislature has been considering this session to get at the heroin issue in Wisconsin. I asked Representative Nygren if Wisconsin has a heroin problem.
There's no doubt. I mean, not only based on the number of deaths we've seen, but the number of crimes we've seen, we definitely have a heroin problem. And I think when people hear that, they perhaps get a little scared, and they should be. But I think there's also a little bit of an embarrassment, not only by family members, but by the community as a whole, because historically, these weren't issues that happened in small town Wisconsin. Awareness is a big part of it. We have to be aware of it so we can prevent it, and we can help those who are already affected by it.
I mean, you can look at mental illness, and when it comes to addiction, too, there's still so much stigma behind the issue.
My daughter, we've shared that story. We dealt with it privately. She has an addiction to heroin, and I think that's the way most people will deal with it because, there's an embarrassment and stigma, as you said, with the issue. But I think for us to be able to tackle it, more people need to be aware of it to prevent it. It's which came first. I think in this case, helping people understand that it could happen to them in their small town, their big cities in Wisconsin, could happen anywhere.
I mean, we're finding heroin overdoses in almost every county, if I'm not mistaken.
We have seen an increase in the number of arrests with heroin, and as Representative Nygren said, as people start to talk about it, they think, well, this is really happening in our community. It's the friends that our kids hang around with, what's happening here. And it is not an issue that is just isolated to the rural parts of the state. It's not isolated to the urban areas. That these task force are popping up across the state because communities and counties want, as they start to talk to each other, they say, what are some of the best practices? What are you doing? What are some good ideas? This is what we're doing. Is there some collaborative efforts that we can work on for applying for grants and some money to do this? And really trying to get a lot of stakeholders from the community involved. We have talked about the task force here in La Crosse, but I also wear the hat of how do our communities in rural parts of the state, as in Crawford County or Vernon County, that don't have kind of the same population area as we do here in La Crosse County, what tools are available to them for law enforcement and schools and nonprofits to come together and address this use?
You asked a question about, is this a big city problem? Is it a small city problem? Well, it is both, as Senator Schilling said. But just to kind of underscore that a little bit, I'm from Marinette, population 10,000, and the county is 40,000, and unfortunately, we lead the state per capita overdose deaths. So it's everywhere. And I think one of the messages we're trying to get out is we don't want people to be naive enough to think it can't happen to them. So we've already talked about this. There's no barrier as far as population. There's no barrier as far as social economic status. There's no barrier as far as race. This can happen in any community, to any family, and that really emphasizes how vigilant we as parents need to be to make sure that we understand that this is a problem.
Senator Schilling, I know you've been in contact with some of the people who have been involved in the heroin task force. But Representative Nygren, why was it important for you to come to this meeting here today in La Crosse?
Well, I think it was important for me to come because, first of all, you want to applaud the efforts of people, citizens just getting involved to try and make a difference in their community, but to perhaps learn some things, get some ideas that we can take back and replicate in other communities throughout the state or in statewide programs. And there were a couple things I made some took some notes, and we're gonna look into some other potential legislation that we can pass to help. So that's communication is a big part of this.
And Senator Schilling, as someone who lives in this community, how big of a difference do you think that this could make for our community?
I think this could be huge. I mean, the theme today was community education about this issue and what we can do for prevention, how we can partner with law enforcement, that we need to continue to talk about this because it's not, I don't want this to be a passing story, that this is just something that we have seen a spike in arrests in 2013, 2014, and we kind of put it then on the back burner. Right now, this is the time that the policymakers are talking about this. This is a time that many of our communities are grappling with this, that we need to continue this strong interest to try to do the right thing, to try to curb use and try to make sure that we can prevent any deaths in the county. I mean, we talked to kind of the theme today or the mission it kept saying was repeated about saying on the paperwork was that we want to prevent any, you know, heroin deaths and illicit use. And so I think to keep that goal in mind, that we need to do that not just when the legislature is talking about this, but we need to remember that there will be another issue that will come before the legislature that will kind of take our time and attention. We still need to make sure that we are, that this is an issue that we need to talk about even maybe after the headlines have gone away.
Can you think of any other local communities that are attacking this in the same way that La Crosse is? Or maybe other communities where you think that they've had some success with this?
Well, you know, my hometown, we have a similar task force. Brown County, Green Bay area has a similar task force. Hudson area. I've traveled to a number of different communities throughout the state over the last couple of months. They're all using similar models of bringing different stakeholders together, all at the same table, to be able to discuss that. And I think that's important. As far as success, we're still fighting it. I'm not naive enough to think that any of the bills that we will pass are going to be the silver bullet to stop this. So this is an ongoing battle, and unfortunately the successes are difficult to measure. Unfortunately, our failures are pretty easy to measure when people die.
You're listening to Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse. I'm Maureen McCollum. My guests today are State Representative John Nygren, a Republican from Marinette, and State Senator Jennifer Schilling, a Democrat from La Crosse. We're talking about heroin in Wisconsin. There's almost this heroin package that passed the assembly.
It passed 96-0. We had three absences that day. We call it the HOPE legislation. It stands for Heroin, Opiate Prevention, and Education. And the reason we came up with that name is because my daughter, I had asked her when I learned that she was using heroin, I asked why. Not only why she was, but why her friends were. I mean, Cassie is a very smart, she was a straight-A student up until, you know, she got involved in drugs. Very pretty, had a lot going for her. But the answer she gave me, and I've heard from other people, young people as well, is they don't have a lot of hope for their future. You know, you look at all the problems we face as a country, as a society, as a world, and it's pretty sad when kids don't think that there's a bright future for them. And as far as dealing with parents who have lost loved ones, they're looking for hope, too. They're looking to have their loss perhaps mean something, that we can make some changes that can prevent somebody else from going through the same loss. So I think the HOPE agenda is a properly named effort, but you know, we've got a long way to go, and we're just at the starting line now.
Why do you think that this point in time now is when this heroin issue is really getting the attention that it's probably needed for a while now?
Well, there's been a 50% increase in heroin-related deaths last year to 199. By comparison, Wisconsin averaged 29 deaths each year from 2000 to 2007. And what I find startling is the statistic that today someone dies of heroin overdose every 44 hours in Wisconsin. I mean, that is just amazing, and it is pretty sobering when you start to look at the statistics and you talk about how prevalent this epidemic is here in the state. So because people came forward to talk about this and wanted action on it, and that there was a lot of conversations going on in a lot of different communities, and finally there's been sort of one voice that could kind of bring this together through the legislature, and it's time. And this is finally, I mean, the idea of sort of the stigma of drug use, and we need to make sure that we can address this, and we are doing it in a way that it's not a partisan issue at all, that all of our communities, that we can talk to people in our community that are involved in this issue and get statistics and get these stories and find users and addicts that will share their story with policymakers. And it's pretty powerful when you have a face and a story. And it's statistics are one thing, but when you sit down with someone who kind of bears themselves and puts himself in a very vulnerable position as being a former user, it's pretty powerful.
Representative Nygren, you mentioned earlier that you were apprehensive that some people might consider or interpret some of these laws as being soft on crime, but that doesn't seem to be the feedback that you've gotten from people?
No, it's actually, I mean, there's always exceptions to the rule, but the feedback so far has been very positive. I think our society is beginning to understand the significance of the problem. We talked about mental health issues in the Assembly and in the Senate in recent months. I think there's a parallel between these two issues, not only in drug abuse for people that have mental health issues, but just the conversation about those two issues. I think the timing was right because we're at a point in time where if we sat down at the table, there were 30 people around the table, I would hazard a guess that almost every single person in the room either had a family member, a friend, a relative, a neighbor that had suffered some type or suffers from some type of mental illness or drug addiction. So I think it has been so far-reaching that the timing is right and people are beginning to understand that there's different ways to tackle this problem than simply locking people up and throwing away the key.
Let's dive into these bills and go into the details of them. One of the first ones in this package that has passed in the Assembly is a bill that would allow emergency responders to use Narcan, and this goes beyond allowing first responders and EMTs to administer Narcan. Why was this an important bill to get through? Why is this something that we need to put in more hands?
Well, a lot of our state is very rural. A lot of our communities, even some maybe the intermediate sized communities, do not have paramedics, professional paramedics available. So the current law for Narcan is you have to be an advanced level EMT, which is basically a paramedic, to be able to carry and administer. So if you live in a rural area and you have to wait 10, 15 minutes for a paramedic to arrive on the scene to administer the drug, that could be the difference between saving a life or a person passing away. So with proper training, the bill will allow basic level EMTs to be able to carry and administer the drug as well.
And here in La Crosse, there's some talks, and I can't remember if it's gone through or not, but for firefighters to be able to administer Narcan.
Yeah, the La Crosse area, we were going to have a pilot program for the La Crosse Fire Department to be able to carry Narcan. And it's just as you talk to people who are involved with this, that use of Narcan and having more people able to use it at the time of finding someone who is overdosed and is in that state, that is life-saving. So if we could expand the use of Narcan as far as those who can carry it and who can use it on those patients, that is really life-saving.
The bill does also allow for first responders, police and fire, allows them the option to be able to carry and administer as well. So I applaud La Crosse area for having this discussion, but now we're going to be able to take this statewide if it passes through the Senate and sign the law by the governor.
Beyond first responders, I know they're at least here in La Crosse and probably across the state too, at the AIDS Resource Center and there are other places, people who are using heroin or maybe their friends can actually pick up Narcan. So in case there's an emergency, they are able to administer it. I know I've heard, at least here in La Crosse, it goes quick. Do you think there will be any sort of efforts towards training people beyond first responders on Narcan?
Well, actually, the AIDS Resource Center is somebody we worked with. While they were doing that, distributing the Narcan, it technically was not allowed under state law. So we did, in this bill, make that change to allow for the training and for the distribution of Narcan. And I think that will continue to be life-saving service that they provide. And we also allowed for the transfer of the Narcan from one person to the other, so it isn't required to have the prescription for it. So once again, I think that's going to be a big life-saving effort.
So is it training the employees, or would the employees pass on the training to maybe different users who come in?
Yeah, I believe the AIDS Resource Center would train their IV drug users to properly use the Narcan.
You're listening to Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse. I'm Maureen McCollum. Today, we're talking about heroin in Wisconsin. My guests are State Senator Jennifer Schilling, a Democrat from La Crosse, and State Representative John Nygren, a Republican from Marinette. Another one of the bills that has passed the Assembly is this 911 Good Samaritan law. Can you talk about what exactly this is?
I can speak very personally about this because when my daughter Cassie overdosed in 2009, I got the call from her mom, who fortunately went home on an August afternoon to shut the windows because there was a thunderstorm coming. And as she was going into the front door, Cassie's friends were running out. They were leaving because Cassie had overdosed and she was lying on the floor, purple, struggling to breathe. Thankfully, the paramedics were able to administer the Narcan and save her life. But we hear these stories over and over again throughout our state where we find people dumped in snowbanks in the Milwaukee area. A young girl was found. We found people in a parking lot of a hospital thinking somebody would find them. We find people in hotel rooms alone or at home. This drug, just like a lot of other drugs, is typically done socially with their friends. But people are afraid to dial 911 to save a life because they're afraid of any type of trouble that they might get into. So what this bill does is it allows for limited immunity for possession and possession of the drug and paraphernalia. Now, when we began looking at that, this issue, there were about 5-6 states back in September that had this law. If Wisconsin passes this law, we will be the 15th state. So what that shows to me is that this is not just a Wisconsin problem. This is a problem that our whole country is facing, and that the legislatures in other states are making taking steps to help save lives.
When you talk about limited immunity, what exactly does that mean?
Well, if you're in possession of the drug or the paraphernalia, you will not be prosecuted if you dial 911 to save your friend. Now, this is actually there's an interesting discussion that we had about this in many states. I think all states, if not most. The 911 Good Samaritan law actually applies to the overdoser as well, the person who's having the overdose. I chose not to do that. And the reason being is from my personal experience with my daughter, the fact that she actually went into the correction system, I think, saved her life because you don't have access to the drug, obviously. The intervention of the correction system can be a potential way for to break this cycle. And, you know, it's still the authority of the DA and, you know, law enforcement in that area. If they decide not to prosecute, they have that ability. But I thought it would be a way to get people the help that they really need is to not give the overdose person themselves the immunity.
Are there any plans to educate people who are using heroin about this new law that, you know, it's okay, you don't have to be afraid if your friend or family member is in trouble, you can call?
Other parts of the bill that in the HOPE package, it does talk about, I think there'll be some PSA or some grant money through DOJ, but it really is for drug repositories, and so encouraging communities to set up either permanent or to have quarterly or something drug repositories so that people can safely get rid of these drugs. I think that many communities, these work groups, are looking at PSAs now with currently the HOPE package is still in the Senate. We need to vote on that. I think we'll be doing that in the next couple weeks in February, and the governor will sign it into law. But once this package of four bills is signed into law, I think that you will see many of these groups will move forward and say, this is a change of current law. Let's make sure that people know that we realize that people are using, the friends are using, that we need to let those people know that you can call 911 and not be in fear of getting into trouble and save your friend's, you know, life, that you wouldn't leave your friend downtown while they're drunk. You don't leave your cell phone, you know, somewhere. You always remember to take your cell phone. You take your friend with you in these situations. And in this situation, it's no different, that you really need to still look out for the friends that you're with.
So this other bill that you mentioned, Senator Schilling, that would allow municipalities to hold prescription drug drives, you know, we have that here in La Crosse on a quarterly basis, I believe. Are there some areas of the state that they don't have prescription drug drives, and is that why this law is needed?
Actually, I think a lot of areas have the prescription drug drives. Under current law, however, they're not allowed to collect narcotic drugs. So what this bill does is allows them to collect that narcotic drug as well and then properly dispose of them. And, you know, when we had the testimony in the assembly, a mom came and said, you know, it was a very powerful moment. Her daughter had died of an overdose, and it began with prescription drugs like it does in most cases. She said, you know, when my kids were little, one of the first things I did when they started crawling and walking was I cleaned out under my kitchen sink to make sure they couldn't get at any of the cleaning supplies that were, you know, potentially dangerous or poisonous. Yet our medicine cabinets are full of narcotics and other drugs that are as dangerous, if not more deadly, than those cleaning supplies. So just really a change in mindset is needed to make sure that we're getting rid of those prescriptions that we no longer use.
And then there's the fourth bill that passed through in this HOPE package that would require an ID to purchase certain narcotics. Can you expand on that and maybe what narcotics that involves?
Yep. The fourth piece is it would require people to show identification when picking up opiate prescriptions at pharmacies. That right now, you have to show a prescription or you have to show a photo ID at some instances for things, but right now, when you go to the pharmacy and you're picking up these drugs, they don't know who they're giving. The pharmacist doesn't know who they are then turning over the prescription to. So I certainly think that is very reasonable to have a photo ID. You still can pick up for someone else, but the pharmacist needs to know and should know who they are then turning over the prescription to. So I think it's a very appropriate and sensible way, and another way that there was probably kind of a way that users could find a way to kind of get around the system, and that they found kind of a crackdown or a breakdown in sort of that area. So that photo ID, I think, will be important as we know who that prescription is being given to.
Yeah, and the reason we introduced this piece is the Brown County Drug Task Force actually asked us to do this one because they have about 8 to 10 cases a month of fraudulent prescriptions. And as Senator Schilling said, once that prescription leaves the pharmacy, there's no way for them to track where it's gone. So very common sense approach. Just show your ID. The pharmacist will write down your name and out the door you go. We don't want to limit anybody from getting the prescription that they need. We just want to know where they're going.
And there are two new bills, Representative Nygren, that you just introduced. One of them is having the Department of Health Services create regional opiate treatment centers. Explain what those are and maybe where some of these test sites are that you're looking at.
Well, the decisions will be made by the Department of Health Services. Perhaps the criteria will be based on, where the need is the most. And it's designed for rural and underserved areas that may not have enough treatment it currently. And once again, they're the professionals, but we are encouraging them to begin this effort, because what we hear over and over again, even if you have somebody who wants to break the cycle, in a lot of our state, we don't have treatment available for them. So this is something that I think is glaringly needed, and it'll be a test focused on I think 1,000 patients, and they'll use abstinence in one of the programs. Another one will use a drug called Vivitrol, and another test will involve a drug called Suboxone, and we'll see which one is the most successful. And if we see a decent level of success, I think you'll see this program going statewide in the future. That's what we're really looking for. We're looking for things that actually will produce results and break the cycle of addiction. We can't allow the citizens, or even if they are addicts, to be disposable to us as a society. We want them to be productive citizens, tax-paying citizens, raising a family, living the American dream like the rest of us.
And how will this be funded?
It will be funded through the state budget, and we've identified some dollars that are available for the program.
I mean, I know DHS will figure this out, but could this be good for La Crosse, Senator Schilling? Or do you think there's an appropriate amount of resources within this area to address addiction?
I certainly think the idea of having 2 to 3 treatment centers throughout the state is going to be needed, that you look at sort of resources that are available. But I think as we look at, of course, we want to deal with prevention, but we also have to look at intervention and we have to look at treatment. And once that we have, people have identified and they're in the system and we want them to change their lives, and as Representative Nygren said, break that cycle, we have to look at the treatment side as well and to give them the tools to succeed after, you know, beyond being in these areas. So I think it's important that we do have kind of this test run, and we will look to see what those best practices are, and we will locate them in parts of the state where really in rural parts of the state, they don't have some of those resources. Here in La Crosse County, we are fortunate with kind of the population that we have here with the health systems and nonprofits and others that can come together. But in rural parts of the state, they don't necessarily have that.
And this final bill, at least that's been introduced for now, maybe you have more coming. this other bill would look at maybe kind of tweaking the system for people who have been arrested for drug use. Can you explain this better?
The problem, as I have seen it, as I've become experience with it with my daughter, but also seeing my community and my area as a whole, we've arrested about 80 people in the last 3 to 4 years with heroin-related crimes. And you know, they might get sentenced to a year in prison, they might get sentenced to 2 years, whatever the case may be. To date, as the people are reintegrated back into the community after their time in prison, there's no success. 100% of them have reoffended and went back into the state prison. We're spending, you know, $35,000 a year for a man, $41,000 a year for a woman in state prison. And the idea behind a correction system is to rehabilitate somebody so that they don't reoffend. So I guess the way I'm looking at it is those dollars are being wasted. The system is not working currently. So we're once again looking for best practices. We identified some things that have been done in other states. Hawaii and Washington have implemented something called Swift and Certain. We're calling it Rapid Response. And it's a quicker and more prescriptive way to deal with addicts and their behaviors to change them long term.
Did you want to add to that, Senator?
Well, I just think in recognizing after they get out of being incarcerated that there needs to be that support within communities as well. And there needs to be job skills, there needs to be those life skills, there needs to be that network also to help them as well. And so certainly recognizing that they have reoffended, it's that treatment, and it is getting them out there to be productive citizens of the community they live.
The states that have implemented it so far have seen fantastic success. Hawaii has seen a 70% reduction in recidivism for drug-related offenses. And once again, you know, Senator Schilling and I both work on the Joint Finance Committee's spending the state's resources that the taxpayers give us. And right now, I think we're wasting a lot of the dollars. So if we can find more cost-effective ways, more successful ways of using our resources, I think the taxpayers win, and the people with addiction will win in the long run as well.
Taking a step back and looking at the state as a whole, do you think that there is adequate funding or enough resources to really tackle the heroin issue in Wisconsin currently?
I think there is because, as I said, if you look at it, if you simply look at this as another cost to the state, you could possibly make the case, oh, we can't afford this, we should maybe put this into education, or we should put these dollars into, you know, some other type of program. And I could understand that argument. But when you look at, as I said earlier, the current cost that were the dollars that are being spent on our correction system with almost no success. I think these programs will actually save money in the long run, and if successful, will also help us have more citizens that are actually contributing to the state, employed, having a job, raising a family. That will actually help us in the long run, and the dollars will be well spent, and I actually believe will save money.
Well, and we do need to be smart on our resources and our investment. And just like in the last budget, we spent $30 million on mental health resources, and many in the mental health arena were applauding us that still is a drop in the bucket of what our state needs for mental health services. And so it's a start. This is the beginning of a conversation. It's going to be ongoing. And if we can curb some of these costs, that could be cost-saving in the long run.
State Senator Jennifer Schilling of La Crosse and State Representative John Nygren of Marinette talking about what the Wisconsin legislature is working on to curb heroin use. Both lawmakers were at a recent meeting of a La Crosse County Heroin and Illicit Drug Task Force. That group has been meeting for several months to talk about what can be done locally to deal with heroin. The group is expected to make its recommendations later this spring. Meanwhile, Senator Schilling says the state Senate could take up some of the heroin bills the assembly has already passed before it adjourns in March. You're listening to Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse. I'm Maureen McCollum. Coming up next, we'll talk with Mike Poplinski, a member of the 1998 U.S. curling team, about his Olympic experience. Archives of this and other recent editions of Newsmakers, extended interviews, and photos can be found on our website at wpr.org/newsmakers. You can also like us on Facebook at WPR Newsmakers. From Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse, this is Newsmakers. I'm Maureen McCollum. The Olympic curling competition began this week in Sochi, Russia. 16 years ago, a Western Wisconsin man was the vice skip on the U.S. Olympic team in Nagano, Japan, but they unfortunately lost the bronze medal match. Mike Poplinski grew up near Galesville and started curling at the Centerville Curling Club. Wisconsin Public Radio's John Davis caught up with Poplinski, who's now an elementary school teacher in Eau Claire, and asked him how he got a start in curling in 1984.
Centerville, La Crosse, and Galesville all at that time had curling facilities, which is rare to have three that close by. And I started with a youth program. I saw a sign-up sheet at my elementary school when I was 10 years old and decided to play, take the school bus out to the Centerville Curling Club and play after school for about an hour once a week.
And then it's just a matter, I assume, of honing your skills over a number of years until you get to this level of becoming world class.
Yeah, it was a long journey. We had some great coaches along the way, and you know, especially with a junior program like Centerville had, there was just very caring people that wanted to share their love for a game and teach young kids how to play. And you know, I played there for all my high through until I graduated, and then I played in lacrosse for my college time as I graduated from Viterbo. So I was able to play with people that were teaching me the game around the area, and just fell in love with competition and competing at a high level.
When did you know that you were destined to compete at a world level, I guess?
You know, it's kind of funny. At the age of 12, we played in our first state competition of juniors, and the junior ages can be anywhere from 12 to 21 at that time, and we were 12-year-olds playing against other teams around the state that were much older, and the fact that we even could compete with them, you know, be on the same sheet of ice was it made me think, maybe someday I can be like that. And you know, I think by the time we were 17, we were finally starting to win some of these statewide competitions and playing in national events. And then we got to the national stage, and Wisconsin is one of the top curling states just because there's so many curling clubs in Wisconsin and Minnesota as compared to other states, that on the national stage, we were immediately a top four team. So once we could win in Wisconsin, I realized, man, I'm close to the top level of my age. And from there, I really started to put extra time into getting better.
And I assume you had folks who encouraged you along the way and said, you know, you can be, elite among curling competitors.
Absolutely. You know, and a lot of coaches of curling are also players of curling. And when you get to, you know, you can play against them and learn from them all the time, it just made it so much easier. And, you know, teammates and friends. And one thing about curling that's different from other sports is that it's really a friendly competition. And when you get people that you're beating and they're congratulating you and pushing you to excel and to move forward, it's a little different than other sports when people don't really like losing. And I felt that the curling community just really embraced good young teams, and my team was one of those at that point.
So how long were you on this, stage, so to speak, of being one of the best in America and one of the best in the world?
You know, being a national level competitor, probably for about 7 years, really elite national level competitor, probably for three. And I really wish I would have spent more time in that. But my family and my occupation started to take over and became first in my mind. And curling is different than other sports. Like I see skaters and other sports where they get one shot at it. And really, curling, you can go multiple times to the Olympics. I have a friend that's on the ladies team right now that'll be in her fourth Olympics. And she was there in 98 when I was, and has been able to make a lot of our Olympic teams in the past years. So there's a long range in the sport of curling, but personally for myself, I was in that that elite level for a shorter time than most.
What is involved in that? I mean, when you are at that elite level, Do you have to devote your life to curling and training and staying in peak physical condition?
All of those things. And I think one of the major parts of that is your time and your availability. And for me, I took an occupation that I don't have a lot of that time in the winter. And that's why I fell off that level a little sooner than others, simply because I didn't have the time to put into it. But people that have stayed at that elite level for a long time have jobs that allow for it, and they do. They commit a lot of time to being in peak physical condition and mentally prepared, and they travel a lot to find high levels of competition, because you know, just don't see that locally. You see a few teams that are recreational, but there are more elite teams you have to travel in to get that competition.
I don't know if it's because of late night talk shows or, you know, I'm not quite sure why curling has kind of been, it's never seen as, you know, you are in peak physical condition, you know, it's not seen as a real sport where you have to be in that peak physical condition, but you really do, don't you?
Yeah, you know, I liken it to golf. I think, you know, you look at golfers and you go from the physical specimen of Tiger Woods to what John Daly looked like. And, you know, I'm trying to think of other golfers' names that were like that, that were able to play at a high level and not be in peak physical condition. And curling's that way. I mean, a number of our athletes don't care a whole lot about the physicalness of the sport, but you do have an edge. I mean, the more physically fit you are, you have a better edge. And you know, my team was certainly not like that back in '98, but I would say this year's team that's representing the guys is much closer to that physical elite level. And the teams that come from Canada that do very well, most of them are physically at a better stage than their competitors.
So if you don't always have to be at peak physical condition, what separates you or what makes you better than the next curling team you're taking on?
I think mental capacity, mental toughness, the ability to strategize and execute your shot. You know, again, unlike a physical sport like tennis or basketball where you're running the whole time and playing at that high level, curling has its physical moments, and then you get a break, and then you get your physical moments, and you have another break. And I think the huge separation at the highest of levels is mental capacity and just the ability to work and do exactly, execute the shot exactly like you're intending to. Think of maybe like a rifle shooter or somebody, some of the archery things that you see in the Summer Olympics. They're not always in the best physical condition, but they can train their heart, and they can train their heartbeats, and they can train different things. And I think curlers are able to do that, where they have the mental capacity to withstand whatever comes at them, and are prepared to make that next shot.
So, what are your recollections of your Olympic experience? You were in the games in Nagano, correct?
That is correct.
1998.
Yeah, you know, my memories are very, very vivid. It's almost eerie how much I can remember from the competition and the Olympic atmosphere. The games themselves, I don't remember a lot because you're just deep into that competition. But probably my favorite memory of the Olympics was the opening ceremonies, where you're surrounded by the best athletes in the world, and I look at myself as this, you know, this player from Wisconsin that's curling that wanted to dream about the Olympics, but when you're surrounded by world-class athletes, it's very humbling. And that was the first thing that always comes to my mind when I think about the Olympics. And then the second goes right along with that is entering the Olympic stadium, marching with your USA on your back and going around that stadium. I tell people I don't know if my feet ever touched the ground. It was just almost an out-of-body experience where you're so proud of your accomplishments and so so on that world stage. It was a moment that I'll never forget.
Did you have time to enjoy some of the other sports, or was it all really about the curling?
Lucky for me, our competition was, you know, the Olympics last, I think, 15 or 16 days, and our competition was immediate. So we were done with about six or seven days left in the Olympics after we lost in our we lost in the medal round. We lost in a bronze medal game, and after that, I believe there were 6 days left in the games, and I was able to stay back on Olympic Village. I get to see athletes. I could go to other events that I wanted to go to, tour Japan some. And watching the other athletes compete at that ultimate level was very, very thrilling. The memory that I have from that was the U.S.-Canada women's hockey gold medal game, where I had pretty good seats and I didn't know a whole lot about hockey, but just the raw emotion that was displayed by those players, it was phenomenal. It was exactly what you'd think of when you think of the Olympics. And I remember Karen Bai, I believe is her name, and she's from a Wisconsin athlete from the River Falls area, and afterwards being draped with the flag and skating around, and just the look in her eyes of accomplishment. And it's really, that's the Olympic movement, right? That's exactly what the Olympics are all about.
Do you have advice for others who are going through this now?
Yeah, you know, I talked to some athletes, and I know the curlers, but, you know, they're hearing lots of great things from their sport coaches, from their coaches that are helping them with dealing with the media, to coaches that are helping them deal with just mental things. And I think my advice to the Olympic athletes is enjoy every moment. You're there for a reason. Compete like you've competed to earn that spot, and the chips will fall where they fall. And the U.S. Olympic Committee and the sponsors for the United States Olympic Committee do such a great job of getting our athletes the best training possible that you just kind of follow the advice of the people around you. You surround yourself with comfort. If you're surrounded by people who are making it really tough on you, then you're probably not going to perform at your highest level. But elite athletes will tell you at any level, if you're going to compete at that highest stage, you have to be in the moment. And I think if you can appreciate the moment and just enjoy every bit of it, you'll have your dream is certainly accomplished.
You're listening to Newsmakers on Wisconsin Public Radio La Crosse. I'm talking to former Olympic curler Mike Poplinski. The Galesville native was on the U.S. Olympic curling team in 1998 in Nagano, Japan, that finished in fourth place. Poplinski began curling as a fourth grader in 1984 at the Centerville Curling Club. I mentioned you finished in fourth place. How do you view what you accomplished? You get to this level, and I know that a lot more people associated with the Olympics in history have been like you. You know, you've been a competitor, but you haven't won all the medals, and you don't have the fame of people like an Eric Heiden or Michael Phelps, who've won multiple medals. But how do you view what you've accomplished?
My life has moved on to a different stage, and being a father and a husband and a teacher and a coach are way more on the forefront of my mind now. And when the Olympics come around, I do think back to those moments. And I think anybody on my team would tell you we'd like to have a crack at that that medal round again. You always want to think that you're at the highest level, and the highest level means you're the best. And we fell a little short of that. And you know, being at the Olympic Games is truly an enormous accomplishment. But when people ask me about how'd you finish, it's really hard to say fourth, because not only personally for my teammates and their families, but also for our country. One thing I remember looking at is the amount of medals the U.S. was winning that year, and to maybe be a part of history and set a new medal count had we medaled. So I think competitors at that ultimate level, they simply want to find a way to show that they're the best. And we came up a little short, and I don't think on it very much, but I do. I get up when people ask, I get to that point where I just wish we had a few shots back, or the rock in my hand, and I wish I was able to make one of those shots that just didn't quite go our way. And but you're right, curling and sports in the Winter Olympics, where you only get one crack at it every 4 years, it is hard to be an elite famed athlete like the Heidens and the Phelps and those people that you remember. And but they're at a different level, and those people certainly work so hard to deserve what they're accomplishing as well.
That doesn't take away anything that you've accomplished. So is that the way you see it?
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, it would be like having Joe Thomas, the offensive lineman that's playing for the Cleveland Browns, come in and ask him if, just because he's an offensive lineman and he hasn't been at the Peyton Mannings of the world, I just don't think that it just diminishes from the accomplishment of his NFL performance. So I like to think of it as, you know, everybody's a little different in where they reach their level.
So when you think back on it, or you talk to your teammates, what would you have done differently in that bronze medal game?
You know, I was very young at the time, and my team was very experienced. And the only thing I've ever thought that we could have done differently is, to talk to my skip, the other members of my team who had a few skeletons in the closet of losing on the world stage, not at an Olympics, but at a world championships, and always taking, third, fourth, fifth, and not quite reaching that ultimate level. And I think there was a lot of pressure on them to be first. And once we lost that semifinal game, I don't think we came out with the same amount of energy, the same amount of teamwork and passion that we had throughout the whole week to go and get the bronze medal. And I think that's a natural emotion. I think if I was the age I am now, or even a few years more seasoned veteran, I could have talked to my teammates about, hey, that one's done. Here's our chance to still bring a medal home and regroup a little bit more. But the way the format was set that year, with once we lost in the semifinals, to have to come back, I think it was like 16 hours later, and try to play in a bronze medal game, we just didn't quite have our minds in the right place. So I think that would be my one take back. If I had a chance to do something a little bit differently, I'd have done it that way.
Who medaled that year? What countries?
I believe Switzerland was the gold medal winner. Canada took silver, and then the bronze was won by Norway, who beat us.
And have they been the traditional curling powers?
Canada always. Right. Canada is always a curling power, and from there it's a host of other countries. Once in a while, the United States, but Scotland is often in there, Switzerland, Norway, and then, like I said, it really rotates. But Canada is usually one of the top two, and then a few other countries find really high-level teams that are competing.
I assume you still follow the sport at the world-class level?
Some. Every 4 years, more often than every year, but I do know some of the top teams and the top names.
Do you have a scouting report for curling this year and can look for?
I would say watch every game that Canada plays. They are special, and how they play the game is really unique. And I watched the Canadian championships to get to the Olympics, and I believe they had eight teams in it. And I made a comment to a friend that I think any of those eight teams could have went and won the gold medal. And now, and the team that's there might not win the gold medal, but I think any of them would have been a favorite going in. I would look for Scotland. I believe they play under Great Britain in the Olympics, but the Scottish team is very talented as well.
Are you still active in curling today?
I am. I play every Wednesday night at the Eau Claire Curling Club, and we have a league up here with 16 teams, and many of the guys are very very new to the sport, and they've learned another lifelong passion. They come out and love it every Wednesday night, and but it's a very social event, not at all at a competitive level. And then a couple times a year, I'll take some friends out of town and play weekend tournaments, almost like a weekend softball tournament or darts tournament or whatever else. And so I take a bunch of friends, and we try to go a couple times a year to see how we can do on a little more of a competitive stage.
Are you involved in teaching at all?
About once or twice a year, I'll get asked to come out with a youth group. And then I, especially during the Olympics, I get asked to talk often with adults that are starting to play. One of my favorite things to do right now is to teach adults another sport that they can come out and do once a week and really find a joy for. And curling is such an enjoyable sport, and the fact that you do help your teammates out and you help your opponents out, and you talk to the person next to you, and you get to meet people in such a social level. And I just love that part of it, and I love what it brings to the people that are there.
What are you doing now? You said you kind of gave up curling for your family and your career, and I knew you went to school at Viterbo,
right?
And you're teaching in Eau Claire, but bring people up to date on what you're doing with your life now.
Sure. I'm teaching fourth grade students at a school in Eau Claire, Wisconsin. I've been here for about 15 years, and put a smile on my face every time I come to work, because there's nothing like the joy of watching students learn and getting to work with young people. So love doing that. Very active in athletics as well, as I've coached my daughter with some sports, and I'm a member of the North High School, Eau Claire North High School baseball staff. So I keep myself active in those ways, and I find joy in doing anything sports related. So I like that, and I just enjoy being around athletics. My wife is a high school basketball coach, so we get to talk about how to help kids improve their skill level, but also to be great people once they're done with their competitive days.
Is there anything else you'd like to add, Mike?
During my Olympic run in 1998, I was a first-year teacher, I mentioned, in the school district of Alma, Wisconsin. I just, when I get a chance, I like to thank them for what they did. They were just so receptive to having their teacher going off to a world event like this, and treated me with class and fundraised for my wife to be able to go. And haven't been there for a long time, but just really appreciate what that school district did for me.
Mike Poplinski was a member of the 1998 U.S. Olympic curling team that finished in fourth place in Nagano, Japan. Poplinski grew up in the Galesville area and learned how to curl at the Centerville Curling Club. He studied at Viterbo University and now teaches elementary school in Eau Claire. He shared his Olympic experience story with Wisconsin Public Radio's John Davis. Thanks for listening to Newsmakers. From Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse, I'm Maureen McCullum. Our production team includes John Gatto, Mary Meehan Strube, and our senior producer, John Davis. To hear archives of this and other recent editions of Newsmakers, visit our website at wpr.org/newsmakers. You'll also find extended interviews and photos. And if you'd like to comment on our program, or if you have a suggestion for future shows, you'll also find links to our producers and staff. That and more at wpr.org/newsmakers. You can also find Newsmakers on Facebook, updates on future shows, links to our archives, and more. Like us on Facebook at WPR Newsmakers.